Hey, yo, everybody. Bunch of questions coming up here on episode number 244 of Shop Talk Show, which I'll mention right at the top, is brought to you in part by Adobe Typekit Marketplace, which is a pretty cool new thing that Typekit is doing in which that it's really beneficial to the foundries. You go and you buy fonts on Typekit Marketplace. They're delivered through Adobe Creative Cloud or through Typekit, but you just pay it once and you have access to that font forever. It's like you bought a font in the regular old way. It's pretty cool. We're going to tell you a little bit more about how it works and all the more cool details about it later in the show. But there's also a bunch of Q&A in this show, bread and butter, Shop Talk Show stuff. We have one about jumping into a project that has a bunch of code that's not exactly how you would have done it, but it's still your project, so you still got to work on it, right? We're going to talk about what's really the difference between a website that's just straight up files, pure code files, as it says in this question, and something like WordPress. What's the difference? How do you go about learning the WordPress way if you wanted to? CSP. A lot of people getting dinged for that lately. If you're using a tool like Mozilla's Observatory that gives you a rated grade on the security level of your website, if you don't have CSP, that's kind of a ding in that. What is CSP? Why does it matter? How do you get it integrated on your site? We're going to talk about that. So many more questions. Does MySQL still matter? What's up with H2? So much stuff coming up, Mr. Dave. For now, kick things off.
There, Shopper Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. The Shop Talk Show. The Shop Talk. That's theme song number two. I went straight from the theme song, Chris, into another.
I see you just went for repetition. I think that's pretty strong. It works in marketing. You know, you just say the name of the thing over and over and over. Get some people's.
Here at the Shop Talk Show, I think we really, you know, just enjoy talking shop on the Shop Talk Show. And I just wanted to blast people with some brand recognition. You know, I think that's one thing our theme song is missing is brand recognition. Shop Talk Show, you know.
Thanks.
Anyway, how are you doing, Chris? How's life? It's a brisk Friday here in Austin, Texas, when we are recording this.
Is it cold? It's funny because this is the second one now I've recorded while I'm down in Miami, where I'll be for the next whole bunch of months. And I've heard it's really warm back home, so I'm not escaping much. Although it just feels weird, like my body's not right, because it's absolutely gorgeously beautiful here.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Just weird. My body's like bracing for the cold.
Oh, you're in like a northern vortex of body climate. Body climate crisis. It is finally cool enough here. I mean, we're talking weather. We're violating a major podcast commandment to not talk about the weather. But it's finally flannel weather, and I'm writing a letter to my congressman and the polar ice caps to not mess this up for me, because I need the flannel season, and if it goes away, I will be very angry.
Oh, I see. Global warming is a concern for you attire-wise.
Oh, absolutely. And a beard and being just kind of an overweight guy. This affects me. This issue is very much affects me.
Oh, I feel you. I really do. Yeah. In fact, that was it's probably my number one reason for not wanting to, the cons of being where I am right now is like, but hooded sweatshirts are like my uniform.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even get to bring any.
Yeah. If global warming destroys the hoodie, what have we learned, society, humankind, you know?
Oh, let's
remember the 90s. If only 90s kids will get this, but you could wear a hoodie anywhere in the 90s, any day of the year.
Without being a criminal, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Only 90s kids will remember that. And we drank out of giant coffee cups, gigantic cappuccino cups.
Can you believe that Transformers are 85 years old?
What? What? Oh, man.
There's some talking about like what we do for a living that's coming up here. And I just talked to you about it briefly that like you got a chance to talk with somebody and they got a chance to tell you about what they do for a living and stuff. I wonder if you want to recap there or do you want to go into this first question and see how it relates maybe?
Well, I was going to say I had a cool conversation with Kevin Jones. Hey, Kevin Jones on Twitter. You guys can follow him. But hopefully I'm not like spoiling, but Kevin was just like, you know, hey, I want to maybe like pick up some work, like kind of freelancing some WordPress stuff. I do it for my job, but I kind of want, and hopefully that didn't get you fired, Kevin. I apologize if that did, but he was just sort of saying like, you know, you guys talk about a lot of stuff here on Shop Talk, like, you know, just frameworks I've never even heard of or thing, you know, concepts I'm not even like, even on the, like, it's not even in my vocabulary. And I sort of like apologize because, and I feel like I should apologize to a lot of the Shop Talk listeners. And just like say, you know, when you're listening to Shop Talk, Shop Talk Show, the Shop Talk Show podcast, shoptalkshow.com. When you're listening to that and you're absorbing that brand recognition, you know, into your bloodstream, you should realize that I and this is my apology.
Oh, is this Kevin, the part where you wanted to do a caveat that it's like, it seems like, I don't know, we get a chance to talk about a lot of stuff, but hopefully that doesn't make it seem like you need to know about every single thing that we talk about in this.
Yeah, I just want to give everyone the out. Like, you don't need to know everything we talk about. And it's okay if you don't. We are pros at talking about things we don't have any idea what they're about. And so I just would want to give people the out. You don't need to know about everything. Like you've probably heard us talk about, you know, I'm thinking about like my lunch conversation with a friend was all about React. And it was just like, if you don't know React or you aren't even interested, that's super fine. But it's probably a buzzword you've heard. And if you're interested in that and you've, I think the advice I gave Kevin was like, if you've like heard it three times and it's kind of on your radar, you know, it might be worth like hello worlding it and just seeing what it is. You know, like this is my new pride and joy. This is a blog post for you, Chris. I have a folder. Maybe I said it in the last episode. I have a folder on my desktop called Hello Worlds and it's quickly becoming my favorite folder. Cause you know, when you like just pull something down from some garbage from the internet and you're just like, well, I'll just keep it in my downloads folder, I guess. But it's like, now it's becoming like this, like list of things I've tried and I kind of like it a lot. It's just a little folder on my desktop.
I guess Hello World on that would be that like when you, especially like the React Hello World wasn't very compelling to me. It's like, okay, load up these libraries, like make this, you know, this app container and then like put this weird JSX in here. And then it just seemed like, whoa, dude, this is a one liner in jQuery. This is not compelling me at all. But what did was the like state management kind of thing and the like the thinking in state. So it's kind of like, I don't know, Hello World doesn't always trigger the awesomeness alarm.
No. But I think it's sort of like, for me, it's just about having like the vocabulary. It's having like a little bit more of like a taste for it. So when it comes up, like when I listen to a podcast or hear people on Twitter talk about it, I'm not just in the dark. It's not like just gibberish I'm listening to, although it can sound like gibberish to me.
So I
went to a meetup this last Tuesday, a JavaScript meetup in town. Shout out to Austin JavaScript. You're my people. But they're talking about like this universal React app and it was, you know, it's doing like A/B testing and all this stuff, server and client. And I just was like, and they're like, yeah, we're using Redux. And I just was like, well, how are you doing Redux like server side, you know, cause I've never heard that. And somebody kind of explained it, one of their engineers, and just was like, yeah, like, well, we like store that context and then that context gets passed. So we have access to it on the server. And I'm just like, I did not know like server side Redux was a thing. And maybe that I don't understand Redux totally, but I just was like, what is that? So I started doing a tutorial on some website and this tutorial, did I say this in the last show? I feel like I did. But this tutorial is weird, Chris. It's not how I code at all. It starts out it's using like immutable JS, which is a whole new thing. You know, it's like these strong typed objects or kind of these new data types.
Now there's like little APIs for like asking permission to change.
And like little shorthands and like weird kind of custom syntaxes and stuff. And then there's like, you know, a list object and a map objects, which are kind of just like fancy arrays. I'm just going to call them fancy arrays and people can email me about it. But, and then it's all test driven development. And I really don't do much testing at all. And so it's all like TDD to the core, you know, it's like, function increment, you know, number takes a number as a value, return number plus one, you know, and then you're like, they describe incrementer, it expects the number to go up. And then you like, you call that function and then you're like, expect number to equal number plus one, you know, it's like, it's so weird, but,
it wasn't so long ago where I did a little pairing with Alex Vasquez, and he was like, he does all kinds of test-driven programming lately, and I was asking for help with the thing. He's like, you know what? Here, let's start over with this. Instead of just like hacking our way through the code trying to make it work, let's write a test first, right? So, because I, as fate would have it, I kind of had some output that I wanted. You know, and I was trying to get there by just figuring it out. And so we just wrote the test that was like, okay, here's the input, here's the output, you know, that we're expecting. Let's get there. And then once that was in place, we could like write a little code, run the test, see if we got any closer. You know, write a little code, run the test, see if we got a little closer. And it turned out to be like a really nice way to work. And it was kind of eye-opening to me. It's not every single opportunity that you have like expected output. And when you don't have expected output, it's a little bit more tedious to write the test because you have to like fake some output. And it feels like you're not being particularly productive, even though you are.
Yeah, like I think my coding style is like Large Hadron Collider. You just throw things at it and smash things together and hopefully find the answer. But test-driven development is very much like it's very slow. I don't know if you got that vibe, but I feel like it's very slow because you're just like, this thing does this thing. And then you hop over to the file that actually does the thing. And then you're like, all right.
But imagine like 2 years down the road, you like now you have this code base that's like badass.
Like bulletproof, right? Like just like, yeah. I mean, you can't like you can break stuff, but like you have now something that tells you, hey, you're breaking stuff. And that's really cool. I guess it's really like slow, but it was almost like Zen, almost meditative. Cause you're just like, here's what I want it. Here's what the number I put into the machine, here's what it needs to spit out. And that's, that's like a basic example. I don't really understand how you do it with very complex things, but I assume it works, you know?
Oh, it works. It can. Yeah. Anyway. So we've jumped around a whole bunch. So let me try to frame some future conversation with this question by Pritesh Panjigir. Recently, my company assigned me a new project in which I have to take a copy of an older project done by somebody else, and I have to change the layout here and there. There's also two more projects in the pipeline in which I have to do it the same way. So the hardest part for me is that the old project is, one, it's written in plain old CSS, and you know, I guess the implication there is Pritesh prefers preprocessing of some kind. And two, there's no structure for the JavaScript, just spaghetti jQuery. So I find it really difficult to work on this project. If I make one change, the layout breaks somewhere else. You know, is there a way I can make life easier without resigning? How would you manage the project? So like I alluded to in the intro to this podcast, this is a situation in which you are assigned to work on something that's just kind of like not how you would do it. So I guess I'm of two minds of this, but I'll pass it to you first, Dave. What do you take on this? It's your job to kind of just hop into a project and make minor changes.
I feel like this is actually my life right now. So it's tough. It's like when you inherit a large code base, like that's a lot of stuff. I'm like, one project is quite literally 100,000 lines of JavaScript, and then one project has like 12,000 lines of CSS or something like that. And I'm like fearful, you know. And I'm sitting there like, okay, when I this 12,000 lines of CSS, because that's easier to talk
don't
about.
You find that that's it's like an additive only situation? If you have 12,000 lines of unfamiliar CSS and you want to change something, I find the only safe way to do that is to add to it, you know, add it. Pick a new class and write new CSS
at the bottom.
Yeah,
I think my approach to solving and learning it would actually put me in a different place. Maybe, Pritesh, this might work for you. It might, like, for CSS, I mean, I think my first strategy would be to break it up and into, like, kind of try to trace the module names and, like, break it up into files, you know? Like, in theory, there's some sort of logic to the CSS. It wasn't just like it wasn't just happenstance that it works out to build the site. So I think I would break it up into smaller CSS modules so that you can kind of be like, oh, that's the header stuff. I'm not messing with the header. Let's get rid of that, you know? So I think that's the strategy I'm going to take. JavaScript, that's tough. I think the first thing you could do, you know, is kind of either A, like, this is kind of the classic open source documentation philosophy or whatever, or open source, getting into open source philosophy, is the first thing you can do is write documentation for it, you know, and that's how you fix it. Like you write out what's going on. And
so this is the, like, get familiar with what's going on so that you kind of stop being afraid of it, or you stop being like, ugh, I don't know what's going on here. Like, get to know
it. Yeah. Well, in like, whenever you, like, inherit a project or, like, you start working on someone else's code, and I'm not saying this about these two projects specifically, I'm just saying, like, in general, like, I think every developer's gut reaction is, oh, this isn't good. I didn't code it, so it's not good, you know? And because we are, like, really petty beings. And so I think you know, one way to get over that just gut instinct that this is just garbage code, like, made by a trash monster, I think, like, you need to, like, kind of dig in and kind of figure out the logic, figure out how things are mapped, and just try to find the logic. And I think once you digest the whole thing, you'll start seeing what people were trying to do. And that's an area you can maybe fix or optimize or, you know, break into a smaller file. I don't think, you know, if it's written in plain CSS and one big jQuery monolith, I mean, I would hope, you know, I don't know that you you have the control, but I would maybe pitch for some kind of pre-processing, web packing or something, for the process, just so you can, like fix some things, like, so you can, like, understand it better, like, break it up and then stitch it all back together. I don't think your bosses will care as long as it's, like, the output's the same, you know?
Yeah, I guess in some situations, like, if you're working alone on it and you have become the, you know, kind of the only person who cares, you know, or whatever, that's the idea. I've certainly been in situations where, like, oh, dude, I am not going to throw a preprocessor on this. That locks me into it, and I don't want to be locked into it. I'd rather just come in and be a little bit helpful when I can and fix the problem that they're having and then get out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. So Pritesh, it sounds like you are a little bit more involved. I mean, this is a company, your boss gave you this project. It does seem like you could kind of, it seems more likely that what Dave's suggesting is a stronger possibility. My two minds are, this is the job in a sense, you know, like, this is what we do as developers. We take situations that, you know, aren't ideal or whatever, and exert our influence and make them better in any possible way you can, you know, hopefully the, you know, thinking about the user first, thinking about yourself and developers second, but still thinking about them, and just do the best you can. In a sense, it's like, you know, if you really are bummed out at this kind of work, that's too bad. But that's the other mind, is that, you know, it doesn't always have to be like this. There are projects in the world where you can you know, you can start a little bit more green field and, you know, work how you want to work and work how you think is successful and stuff. So if this job is only working in a way that you really dislike and don't feel like you have any control over, yeah, I mean, there are other possibilities in that. I empathize with that being like feeling like, gosh, I'm good. I know how I want to build projects. I think I'm pretty good at it, and I never get the opportunity to do that. Oh, that sucks, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, if it's ruining your job satisfaction, I mean, I would talk to somebody about it, you know? That, I think that's fair, right? That's that's the old shop talk advice.
Maybe the medium, you know, the in-between here is like, hey, boss, like, can I take a crack at one of these projects? Might take a little longer, and I'm just going to redo it, but like in a really good way, the Pritesh way.
A documented way.
Sure, yeah.
I was going to say, like, if you're having trouble with like the CSS, you change something and it breaks something thing, you know, we were talking about testing before, right? You could set up tests, and there's this thing called visual regression testing. And I'd point you to Micah Godbolt. He kind of has a bunch of posts and talks on this sort of thing. But there's also a website, I guess I just found. Visual Regression Testing.com. And they have a little, like a course, a 6-day little course, email course. So they email you like each lesson each day. So you can kind of kind of figure out how to implement visual regression testing, and that might save you a bunch of headaches. You know, if you're changing something and it's breaking something, you add some test coverage to kind of safeguard yourself against it. And I'm seeing a post on CSS tricks too, Chris.
Yeah, we have a couple of them. We've covered it a number of times over time. You know, there's some people that have sweared by it and said, you know, I'm in this a Pritesh-like situation here in which I have this big code base and I want to, for example, just switch it over to SAS. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, well, great, but that's tricky. I mean, I'm changing code here, so I'm pretty confident that I can do this without affecting anything, but you never know. So why not set up something like this that, you know, takes screenshots and looks at those screenshots of pages and compares them when I make changes, and just see if for sure I didn't change anything. I mean, it's certainly one way to check that out and then start making changes. And, you know, it's a little bit like test-driven development for visual test-driven development in a way.
Yeah, it's sort of like, okay, I changed stuff. What messed up, you know? And then you're not, to borrow a phrase, you're not caught with your pants down. You like know what changed, and maybe you're okay with those changes.
I should say it's not mega, mega popular. Not in a way that like, you know, Ruby testing and whatever, you know, unit testing.
I think it's not easy. Like, it's doable, but I don't think it's just like, gem install run tests.
No, you know, it's not. It's not at all. I think it's prone to false positives. And so some of these articles in CSS Tricks address some of these things. So it's worth reading about. But yeah, it's tricky.
Yep. So I'm not, you know, it's, I think that would look into that. And I didn't intend to segue into that question that well, but hey, that's what, a lot of surprises here on Shop Talk. Next question, Chris, you ready?
Yeah.
Cameron Burkholder writes in, when you guys make websites, do you host a set of pure code files or do you use WordPress? Interesting. And if you use WordPress, how do you go about learning it?
Okay, so it's a pretty broad question, but I think it gets at a somewhat popular Shop Talk Show topic, is this idea of static site generators, right? And I don't even know if Cameron, it sounds like maybe you've never even heard of that or whatever, but Cameron says, do you host a set of pure code files? And what I think of, I think what Cameron's probably thinking of is like, I can just make an index.html file. I can just make a style.css folder. I can link those two things together and I can make a website with those things. And you're damn right you can, Cameron. And I think not enough websites even do that. And in fact, I've been getting a kick out of it. I've made two or three of them lately, for different reasons. And I even have like a workshop I'm working in. And I think that's what we're going to do. We're not going to pick a CMS because I want to talk about front-end development and some other topics in front-end development. And I don't really, like, I love thinking about and talking about CMSs, but that's not what I want to focus on in this. I just want to build a website and talk about responsive design. I want to talk about performance. I want to talk about offline. I want to talk about SVG. I want to talk about animation, pre-processing, accessibility. There's all these things we can talk about, and we can talk about that all with an index.html file and a style.css file. For the most part, maybe not offline. That's going to require some other stuff. But all those things require those two files to work with. So when I'm making a website, I'm like, dang, I can make a pretty nice website for a band with those two files. I could make a pretty nice website for, you know, my gym with those two things. I have all these ideas of like, I could make a pretty nice little one-page app with just those two files. So Cameron, you can do that. His question, though, is like, oh, or do you use something like WordPress? And I think most Shop Talk Show's listeners probably have a pretty good sense of when you would kind of level up into that, wouldn't you say, Dave?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're fine to just throw HTML up on a server. I mean, it should just be that easy. It can be just that easy. I think where you want to get into WordPress is like, if all of a sudden you find yourself copying and pasting a whole bunch, now you're getting into templating. And templating is where you kind of want to start, like recycling little pieces of code, you know, the PHP include header.php, PHP include footer.php. That's where like something like WordPress starts coming in. If you have a blog, like content that just spits out, you know, and it all looks the same, a database is what you want to use for that. And WordPress does that really well. So I think, you know, don't sell yourself short. I saw
this get weird because there's just a million things we could talk about as how to approach this. That's in between index.html as a static file and WordPress. Because there certainly is, and I think a lot of us know that. But this is just one in between step that I think is fairly compelling, and it's Pug, which is their new renamed Jade.
New Jade.
Yeah. And I don't know which of these features, if any of these features are particular to Pug or if Jade had them too, but I've been messing with Pug and I think it's really nice. It's an HTML preprocessor, but it's I don't even really care about that, I guess, as much as I care about the fact that it has this particular feature called templating, essentially. I think that's what it's called. I'm trying to look through the exact docs, but you can make a template file and then make another file that like inherits from it. You just write this one line. It says extends layout.pug, and in layout.pug, there's just a place where you just say block content, block footer, block scripts, or whatever. And then you have another file that extends that layout, and you are also writing HTML, but then you write block scripts, and then you put some scripts in there, and those two things get like smashed together to make the final file. And it's like, it allows you to, you know, just what you were saying, like PHP include header or whatever, but it's kind of a way that you have to do that without needing PHP, because you know, not as soon as you need PHP, then you have to, now you're on, you're not, it's not really a totally static site anymore and has PHP as a dependency as stuff. Where Pug, you just kind of run locally and it smashes those into HTML files and you have that ability. I just think the way that it does it, I did a really bad job of mouth blogging that or whatever, but the way that it does it is nicely elegant, and it allows you to make, you know, an X page site. You know, you could blog with this. I think of it almost like Jekyll, you know, like you could, your blog posts then become just like block content, and then you just, you know, write in Jade your post instead of Markdown. But I think you can even kind of do Markdown too, or you could have the block extend a Markdown processed file. So anyway, I'm doing a terrible job of this, but look into Pug. I think it's pretty compelling.
It's a cool, yeah, no, I think that's cool. So, yeah, I was going to say I found a funny tweet. Everyone loves when you read tweets on the podcast. But Henning Koch tweeted the other day, is like, hackathon standards for success over the years. In 2009, a success was build a prototype. In 2012, Render hello world. 2016, configure build pipeline. So, you know, it's like the joke there, Chris, I'll explain the joke.
Okay.
Is it's getting harder.
It's getting harder. Yeah.
People are producing less stuff in hackathons. It's taking longer to build a website. That's the joke. That's the
yeah. Even years and years and years ago, I went to more of those than I do now. They are fun. I definitely have been to like a 24-hour one where we were 12 hours in and we're like, okay, we have Rails installed on everybody's machine now, and everybody has access to the Git repo. Now somebody make a logo. You know, like damn.
Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah. Here's the same tweet from I Am Developer, popular comedic developer account. Hey, how did your hackathon go? Not too bad. We got Babel set up. Yep.
Yep. I saw that one the other day.
See? Funny, yeah. Funny jokes about the current state of front-end tooling.
God, if only there's a website where all you had to do to turn on Babel was just choose it from a drop-down menu.
Oh, man, that would revolutionize things and probably earn my monies every month.
We're talking about CodePen, cha-ching. Let's see. Brian Reich. Oh, good luck. You know, Cameron, I know you asked us for WordPress learning resources. I think you'd probably do a pretty good job just Googling that, because there's an absolute millions and zillions of them. I have WordPress courses, for free on CSS Tricks, if you'd like to check those out and stuff. There's absolutely no shortage of WordPress learning material
and
out
that
there.
That was an audio question, too. Thanks, Cameron, and I blew it.
Ugh. Yeah, I was kind of pausing, waiting to see if you would do it, but it was a little old too. So, Brian Reich writes in. This is a very different question.
let's take a little break.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Typekit Marketplace, which is a brand new way of selling fonts with the prices set by the foundries. So you, us, we get to go to Typekit Marketplace, buy fonts for a one-off cost, and it's ours forever to use on the web and on desktop apps. All the fonts sold on Marketplace can be used both on the desktop and on the web, which is great. So there's over 2,000 fonts that were not previously available on Typekit before, but foundries are involved now. It's their largest expansion ever, with notable foundries like Farrar Jones and the Type Network. So you buy a font for a one-off cost, and it all still works through Adobe Creative Cloud, but you don't have to have a paid account necessarily. You can use a free Creative Cloud account, which is good because it's a really nice app that allows you to sync these fonts that you buy to your desktop machine as well. So you're not dealing with font files manually. You just like sync the font, boom, it's available on your desktop machine for use in any desktop application, which is great. But of course, Typekit is known for using the fonts on the web as well. That's still just like normal Typekit too. You can use them on the web and they're delivered through all that Typekit technology, which they have tons of smart people there doing best practices stuff to make sure that those fonts are delivered in the best possible way for the modern browser landscape. And it's fast and it's CDN'd up and all that stuff. So you buy these fonts at a one-off cost, they're yours forever, and you get to take advantage of all the things that Typekit does better and amazingly for you, which is great. So it's just a new purchase model from Typekit with a huge addition to what they offer. Amazing release by Typekit. Go check out typekit.com/marketplace.
Okay, we're back.
Mozilla's Observatory, Dave, you've seen it. It gives you an A through F grade on, how web page test or whatever also gives you a grade, but it gives you a grade based on the performance of your website. Observatory gives you a grade based on the security of your website, at least the things that it can test by just looking at it, poking at it, it doesn't I don't think it actually tries to hack you or call your bank or anything, but it just it tests what it can by looking at the code. Brian Reich says, I got an F basically, and I was relieved to to hear that one of you got an F from Observatory too, because my site fails miserably. I want to do better. The first item on Observatory's report card was the content security policy. So that's Content Security Policy, CSP. Anytime we hear CSP, that's what that is. It basically tells the browser where it's allowed to run styles and scripts from. I think it can do a bunch of other stuff too. Simply adding a CSP header to your site doesn't allow inline code. It's going to break pretty much any WordPress site that has themes or plugins that outputs inline CSS or JavaScript. I've never found it to be a good solution for... Et cetera. He's basically like, I'm getting dinged for this. I want it, but this is going to be real hard to integrate.
This I think is a big problem, and I think no one's talking about it. And I have a whatever, a cork board on my wall with a bunch of red yarn about this.
Really? Do you think it's a conspiracy? I'm a big fan, honestly. We have it. We knew we wanted it at CodePen and went through a long sprint to get it activated because it's so good.
Well, yeah. So we should back up. Like a content security policy is basically it's a header that just goes into that ships with your document, like your page, your HTML page, and it basically says there's a lot of security headers, but this one is kind of like only do use HTTPS, like use HTTPS, and then you can kind of fine grain control the rest of the stuff. But just the default use HTTPS says don't execute any inline scripts or any inline styles.
That's the best one. Of all the things it can do, that's the best one. And it doesn't block scripts, period. It can block scripts that aren't from your own domain, which is pretty cool, and I'd recommend doing that one too if you have a web app kind of thing. But it also blocks any inline scripts. Inline script meaning like imagine open script tag, alert test, close script tag. That's not linking out to a JavaScript file. That's writing JavaScript right in line, right? And the content security policy is going to say, nope, never, none. Under no circumstances will I execute that. And the beauty of that is that's every single XSS attack, which is cross-site scripting, which is I'm going to figure out some way to execute JavaScript on your site. And once I've figured that out, I can now steal a cookie or steal a session or whatever and then log in as that or whatever by just installing that cookie on my own machine. That's super dangerous. It's super bad. And if you get content security policy going, it just cuts that off at the knees. It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. Like if I somehow, like on CodePen, if I set my job title to, you know, $Ajax delete, you know, pens, ABCDG, you know, like,
right. Another one too. It's not only just stealing the session, but if you found some like API on our side that is like has to be run in a certain way, yeah, you could hit an Ajax request from us that like, yeah, deletes our pens, deletes the pens of that account.
I'd like go to everybody's pens and start liking them, and they'd visit my profile, and then I would just firebomb. I'd be just deleting people's pens out of nowhere. Wouldn't that be hilarious? No, it's not hilarious. Have a good CSP. So here's my thing with this, and I think I've been working on blog posts. I've been working on since that episode where I got an F on Observatory. I've been like locking down my site, and this is one part where if I implement the default HTTPS, on my static site. Let's ignore the static site part. But if I implement that default HTTPS content security policy header, my comments will quit working, my analytics will quit working, my load CSS will quit working, my inline critical CSS quits working. All of these kind of tools for like lazy loading scripts and little techniques I've built up for like performance and progressive enhancement and things like that, they don't work, Chris, in a CSP world. I'm a little bit worried about this. So I think to get it to work, you have to do unsafe inline. You can add the like, yes, run unsafe inline things, but it's kind of gives you the heebie-jeebies to be like, yeah, run unsafe code on my website. That gives you a heebie-jeebies, doesn't it? So I don't know, Chris. What do you think?
I'm trying to test some sites, and I'm like, dude, this is giving incorrect results for one thing. Either that, or I need to look into some stuff right away.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that you can't just, if you get an F, you can't just be like, oh, let me read up on this. Oh, CSP sounds good. Chris and Dave said it was cool. I'm just going to turn that on. Don't do that. You need to really read and look around at your site. At least test it in development heavily, because there is a lot of stuff that's going to break, things that are unexpected. Brian, who wrote this question, says that, yeah, dude, a WordPress site, that's going to be rough, especially one that, like, you know, uses a bunch of plugins. And a lot of those plugins, even WordPress itself does this quite a bit. It says like, oh, I see you're logged in as the admin, so I'm going to inject a little CSS into the header that styles the site such that I can make room for that like admin bar at the top. Well, if you have CSP configured to not allow that, it's not going to happen. Or like, oh, here's a little bit of like user-specific JavaScript, and I'm going to like, what's the username? I need that in a JavaScript object. I'm just going to inject that into a script into the footer or whatever, so I have access to that in JavaScript. But it doesn't work because it's inline JavaScript, and it's like you can be shooting your own app in the foot. Certainly a plug-in heavy WordPress site is going to be destroyed by this.
Oh, analytics, tracking, performance metrics.
Your WooFoo form, gone, you know, or, yeah. So, you know, it wasn't that hard. Like Google Analytics, a lot of this stuff, like we still use WooFoo forms. You just put it in external JavaScript that's hosted on your own site and you link it up, you know. It's like not
but
that
it's
bad.
But it's going to take a little longer to fetch and execute. It's not happening, like, it's not like an async script injection right there, because you've added a script has to fetch and then inject another script, right? Does that make sense? So instead of the page requesting that async, you know, third-party widget, your page has to request your script and it has to execute that script and then it has to load that third-party widget.
Yes. You know, so it's, yeah, whatever. It's kind of like how inlining some CSS or inlining SVG, oh, nice, it doesn't have to make that request for that file. But in this case, it's like there's a slight performance trade-off for security.
Oh, man, what on earth? I think you should institute the CSP and have like the unsafe inline specified. But yeah, I think it's a problem. I think the way we kind of build websites right now is a little bit, of a problem. This also has cascading effects. Like if you can't do inline styles, you know, that whole React inline style thing kind of starts falling apart, you know, like if you have a good CSP.
Yeah.
I think this is where my wall of red yarn comes from, Chris. It's like, this is, no one is talking about this. So I think it's I don't know. I could be wrong. I could be a crazy man in my flannel shirt in my bunker
Austin, Texas. What people are talking about, but not talking about in the way I want to is H2 also HTTP2. We have a question here from Hassan about that. So let's move to it and see what happens.
Let's move. Yeah. Shake it up.
Am I the only one who thinks despite H2 being on the horizon, nothing should change in terms of workflow? This is Hassan Mehdi. I feel like an overweight person discovering low-fat ice cream and thinking it's the answer to all their problems. The fact of the matter is that H2 is going to improve load performance, but that shouldn't be an excuse to fatten up the size of files being delivered. I've decided I will keep every file minified and optimized to every inch of its life. Have I misunderstood a fundamental aspect of H2? What do you guys think? So, I still think, yeah, you should probably to minify and optimize files still under H2. I mean, I don't think anybody's saying don't use gzip or don't use, you know, min.js. Are they?
No, I don't think. I mean, we've maybe said like, oh, you know, maybe you don't have to minify because gzip will fix it all for you. But, you know, I think it's still a good practice to minify, you know, things you're sending over the wire. Or the radio tower.
Yeah, H2 or not. What I think people are saying is this idea of concatenation might be not
as useful or an anti-pattern in HTTP2. And I think I've brought this up several times, but I've yet to get a really good answer on this. And let me set it up for you, Dave, and you tell me the answer to this. Let's say right now I want to start using HTTP2. And as a matter of fact, I am. I have CSS Tricks at least configured to serve in HTTP2. I haven't really done anything with it, but it's serving in it. And the idea is I was willing to turn it on because I don't think it's going to be any worse under HTTP2. It'll be the same or better. But the idea is that, you know, the information going around, whatever, and there's technical reasons for this that I kind of understand, but not entirely, is that there's no penalty for multiple requests from the same domain. So let's say I have 20 icons on a site. We have been jumping through hoops for a decade or longer to combine all of our icons into a single file because we don't want to incur the penalty of like 20 pings and 20 HTTPS handshakes and all that stuff for all 20 of those icons. It's much, much, much more performant and better to smash them all into one request. That could be an icon font, that could be an SVG sprite, that could be a CSS sprite. We've been smashing icons together forever. In an HTTP2 world, we don't have to do that. It's not just icons, this is CSS as well, JavaScript, any resource that we've been smashing them together to reduce requests. They say in our HTTP2, we don't have to do that anymore because there's no penalty for having multiple requests. They're all just going to come down just like if they were smashed together or not. There's no penalty for that, so they say. I don't know what the limitations for that. I don't know if you could do it. If you had 1,000 files, is that still okay? Is there gray area here? I'm not sure, but let's just assume that it's true that don't smash files together. That does seem like, Hassan, that if that's 100% true, that it does, that concatenating files is still a problem, because imagine the third and 17th icon need to change. Well, browser caching is still a big deal in H2, of course, because if you don't have to make a network request at all, you might as well not. If I have to change the third and 17th icon in a concatenated world, I have to invalidate the entire thing. In an HTTP2 world, I can just invalidate the third and 17th one, and I'm all good. So that's where the anti-pattern part comes in here. But my question is, can I do this today or not? Am I really hurting browsers that don't support it in a way? And is there actual performance benefits? I'd like to see, maybe I'll even make up a test page that has 20 icons on it and you know, get strong performance metrics across a whole bunch of browsers running in HTTP1 and then switch it to HTTP2 and see what the performance metrics are across all those other browsers. Like, why are those tests not easy to find? Seems like that should be the conversation right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some, but they're really not helpful. It's like, if you have 2,000 files, it's better to concatenate, you know? And it's like,
yeah, there are limits. That's what I've been hearing, yeah, too. Like, it's not a total panacea of just load whatever you want.
But no, I think the main benefit of H2 is that it makes it reduces the handshakes. So when we meet, like right now, it's like anytime you and I, Chris, would have a question, we would have to do a handshake, like a physical, like, oh, hi, I'm Dave. And you'd say, oh, hi, I'm Chris. And then it'd be like, Chris, can I have this PNG? And you'd say, oh, yes. And then when I want a JPG, I go, oh, hi, Chris, I'm Dave. And you'd say, hi, I'm Chris. Can I have a JPG? And you'd say, yeah, you could have a JPG. Like, and now it's just like, we meet once, I can keep asking you for questions. That connection gets cheaper and faster. So I think it's good. I think I've seen it on image heavy sites. I was doing my 3 seconds on 3G thing the other day, or on Twitter, maybe a few weeks, months ago on Twitter, and people were sending me like network panel screenshots and stuff. People who had H2 on photography heavy sites were just, oh, so fast. I mean, it's just like where you'd usually see like 3 items bundled in a waterfall. Like H2 is just like, no, I got them. I just, oof, it's so good.
And there's more to H2, right? I mean, I know we're mostly talking about the waterfall here and the multiple requests and stuff, but there's like push and stuff too. So I don't want it to seem like, oh, this is the only thing that H2 does. But
I think that's like part of it. I think there's quite a few things that H2 does, but this is kind of the main benefit. Is it cheapens that handshake between things? It also does like push, but you have to configure that. Blah blah blah. I think it's good. And I do wonder the limits. I still worry about execution order. You know, if I write script A, script B, script C, and script A shows up last, do B and C fail? You know, did I plan for that in my JavaScript? I think I still need probably a thin layer of concatenation, you know, to maintain execution order. Like I want the one JavaScript file to show up at the one at all together, but I don't know enough about it. I've never done some heavy splitting there. So
I assume that's going to be a hot topic for a while though. But Hassan, just to recap, I don't think anybody's saying, please make websites bigger because H2 is so much better that it doesn't matter that we bloat the size of websites. That's definitely not the case. Keep minifying, keep optimizing, that kind of thing. But the discussion is a bit wider. So
yeah, I think it's supposed to make what you do right now a little better. Like, and then it brings that question, do we have to concatenate? That's sort of the question.
Yeah, I'd like to stop. I can't wait to stop concatenating files. I think that sounds like a pleasurable place to work.
You should just roll it out on do it.
If there was like 10 icons, I would do it, but I have a feeling that it's just not a great idea just yet. But yeah, I mean, the future of icon systems is image source equals icon.svg. Yeah.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is sponsored in part by Indeed Prime. Indeed Prime helps tech talent such as software developers and data scientists simplify their job search and land their dream job. Candidates get immediate exposure to the best tech companies with just one simple application to Indeed Prime. Companies on Prime's exclusive platform message candidates with salary and equity information up front. The average software developer gets 5 employer contacts and an average salary offer of $125,000. Pretty good jobs here on Indeed Prime. Indeed Prime is 100% free for you, for candidates. No strings attached. When you're hired, Indeed Prime gives you $2,000 bonus to say thanks for using Prime. That's a pretty hearty thank you. I used to shake the guy's hand and got me a job. I'll take the $2,000. That's better. Sign up now at Indeed.com/Prime.
You got this one on from Mail?
Yeah, Mail Burnett, Brunette, sorry, writes in. Hi, I was wondering what your thoughts were on the best way to call large CSS or JS libraries like Twitter Bootstrap onto your page. Whenever convenient, I like removing all the stuff I'm not using from a lib so as to keep the file size to a minimum and avoid the cruft. But on the other hand, I can see the advantages of referencing the whole thing from a CDN. What do you think is the best solution, particularly with performance in mind? And thank you. Well, I mean, we just talked about performance. I would certainly comment out everything like whatever, remove all the stuff you're not using. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, this has come up a number of times, the like, should you run some kind of intelligent unused CSS thing on it? And I've been starting, the more I looked at I was kind of anti those tools for a minute, but when I buckled down and looked at one, if you really like do a really good job with some of those remove unused CSS tools, they're actually pretty smart. Some of them fire up a headless browser and you give it a list of URLs to test and it executes JavaScript and stuff. And it's pretty intelligent at finding unused CSS. So that's, it's not the worst thing in the world, but I have a feeling like somebody who's just like blasting together a Twitter, a Bootstrap page and just is a little worried about size is maybe not in the position where they're like doing some serious DevOps stuff.
Right. I mean, well, and for V1, you can ship like this is maybe my critique of like web performance folks. I'll include myself in that category. It's like things can get better, like you can just ship the whole Bootstrap. But if you have a budget and a plan to go back and make it better, you can do that too. Like you're not just like cursed, like when it launches with everything, but it's probably a good idea to schedule time and budget to go back through and make it even better. Like,
it's something we don't mention enough, possibly for as many times as it's been kind of required that we talk about Bootstrap. Which I have no problem. I feel a little weird because it comes up so often. I've like basically never used it, you know, and I think it's really awesome in this great project. And we talk about the good accessibility of it and whatever. And, you know, Bootstrap 4 is going to be sweet and stuff. There's getbootstrap.com/customize. That's something I feel like we've never mentioned on this show. One of the ways that you can get less Bootstrap is to come to this page and only click on the checkboxes of the stuff you need. And then download that, you know, it's kind of like what people always wanted from jQuery that they didn't do in a really great way, I don't think. And
well, this is great. So I do print, I do a little typography, I got a grid system. That's all I need. And yeah. a bunch of carousels, modal, all these guys. Users love these. I'm going to now ship it. How big is it? Does it tell me how big it? Oh, wait, I'm going to get rid of all these jQuery plugins. I need the carousel plugin and the modal plugin. And I'll just assume these less variables are all right. Whoa, these are a lot of less of it. Compile and download. I'm getting it live on the Shop Talk Show. Live downloading here on the Shop Talk Show. Just what you... And my browser crashed. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yay, Edge. Anyway... I got
it. Did your browser actually crash? See, that's what makes me nervous about recording the show. Well, every time when there's like, oh, there's record this podcast in the browser. What if it crashes? But I guess what if the thing we use now crashes too? I guess something can always crash.
Everybody crashes. Sometimes our REM don't sue us.
We only have one more. We might as well just do it. I've managed to pick the exact correct number of questions this time. Magnus Scare writes in about on the topic of SQL. Hey guys, great podcast. High five. I still am quite new to all this, but is MySQL being phased out? I've heard talks about MariaDB, but couldn't find much useful on the issue. So phased out is it's a kind of a funny way to put it. Because when I think about the web, it's just this massive place. You know, there's no technology that could just be phased out on the web.
Yeah, it's not like Tim Cook is like phasing out databases. But
is it going out of favor? Is it not something that people learn anymore, et cetera?
Can I give you my hot drama perspective? I feel like I have a pulse on the industry hot drama, Chris.
You do? Good.
I do. MySQL was bought or acquired, I think, by Oracle. Mm-hmm. Oracle is a big company with a lot of motivations to make more money. I think when that move happened, because you can use Oracle database or whatever, and that costs billions of dollars to big fancy companies. I think there was a little bit of a fear that MySQL would suddenly start costing a bunch of money.
Right. I think they could do that if they wanted to, maybe, or maybe we have that wrong, but the idea is they could change the licensing on it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just like, if you have over 100 million tables, you owe us $1 billion or something, you know. It just when something kind of indie kind of goes in the hands of something kind of a big organization, you know, they on launch day is always like, we will change nothing, they will operate autonomously, it's everything's great, and then a couple of years later they're shutting down Vine, you know. I'm still not bitter, or I am still bitter. So I think there was sort of like a little bit of what is the future of MySQL from within the MySQL community? You know, I think.
Right. And that's a number of years ago now. And I don't know how to follow up on it, except for that it doesn't seem like that happened. And it seems like the way that Oracle is monetizing MySQL is by offering like cloud services for it.
I think that's right. And I think there was a whole NoSQL phase that came and went.
Exactly. Half of the story here is that, okay, we're worried about Oracle, although that kind of seems fine. The other half of the story is the one that I think is more prevalent is that the MySQL is like kind of old school or something. It's like the PHP of or whatever, you know, people like whatever, fairly or unfairly make fun of PHP for just like being old and whatever. And why not get on a hip new language? Well, the hip new language of databases isn't MySQL. MySQL is the old dinosaur. New hip stuff. Maybe it is MariaDB or CouchDB or NoSQL.
MongoDB. Thing. Yeah. Sure. There's a new database every week. They all kind of do different things. And one also like contender or Postgres, whatever threat would be Postgres. I kind of use Postgres as a deployment like exclusively. Like Heroku offers it. It's actually pretty darn good. And so I like it. And it's not it's the same syntax basically as MySQL. Maybe it's got a little custom features. But the kind of killer feature of Postgres is it actually can act like a flat file if you like set it up to do that. So, but it's not, you know, MySQL is not dead. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think like you should not hesitate to build an application on it. I think people kind of, we went through this like craft beer phase of databases and, you know, Budweiser's still a pretty good beer, man.
So. People are back to Budweiser.
Yeah, went full circle. People are back to butter.
Yeah. We had a weird moment. I don't know if this is over Sherry at CodePen, where we were really close to switching to Postgres, and we knew that it was going to be a bunch of work, but we had a contractor person who was really into the idea and wanted to switch it for whatever. There is some advantages to like a file, you know, like the idea of storing a file is like feels a little better in Postgres RAN, I think, than it does in like just storing a file as in a table in a MySQL database, although we do it and it's fine. Yeah, like a blob. I don't know why it's better. I don't really wrap my head around it, but I remember our internal conversations were about it. It was like, okay, if we do this, it's going to take this long and it's going to take this amount of money. I get that. I'm looking at the numbers and the timing and stuff right now and the human beings that are going to be involved in this and the timetable, all that stuff. At the end of this, what's different? What's better? And everybody involved was like, nothing. There's no difference. There's nothing user facing. There's no speed benefit. There's no maintainability benefit. There's no like we can't. It's not going to be easier to hire people to work with. You know, like every single question, I was like, what is the thing that when we're done with this, CodePen is going to be better for? And there was nothing. And that's not even why it got killed. It got killed for other reasons. People were still ready to move forward with it with that. And I just found it just mind-bogglingly weird that we were about to pull the trigger on it with a zero benefit.
Yeah, like a net zero improvement. Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah. Well, I think that's it. I think it's almost like a Coke Pepsi thing. You know, I used craft beer, but I'm going to go switch the analogy now to Coke Pepsi. I mean, a lot of databases have this Coke Pepsi thing. When you write your application, you typically use like an ORM is that what they're called? Object relational mapper. Is that what they're, just some sort of like database adapter. Like you typically don't like write the raw SQL. Although you could, but typically I think in modern application development, you're kind of using an adapter that interfaces with the database, the target database. So your choice of database is going to matter. Like it's sort of like depends on what you need to do with that data. They're not going to go out of like, they're not going to like disappear, but I would, unless you like clearly understand the benefits of like a brand new hot on the scene upvoted on Hacker News database, like unless you understand the value of that, this is conservative Dave talking. I would not just jump on it. I would only jump on it, like you said, Chris, if you have like a concrete reason to make it, like the concrete benefit is very clear, I think. So
Yes, absolutely. You know, so that flat file thing that you mentioned, we just kind of glazed over that. But I think that's in some cases, that's a pretty compelling thing because, you know, whatever, I use MySQL all the time for all kinds of stuff. And like, there's no, now moving a SQL database is like, it's, you know, I don't know. It's not that bad. It's cause I'm a whiner, but there's not just some file that I can FTP somewhere or whatever. A flat file there is, which is kind of awesome. It can be a part of your Git repo and all that kind of thing. Whereas with MySQL, you have to like, you can export it to an SQL file, but an SQL file is just like a backup of a database. That's not your actual database. You need to then, you know, move that file somewhere and then execute that SQL into the database. The database has its own login system and credentials and all that stuff. It's a much more complicated affair, you know, whereas a flat file is just flat file.
Hey, flat file.
Pretty cool. That's a pretty compelling reason. If it's really simple kind of thing, that's kind of a good reason.
That's where like SQLite was kind of cool. It was like, oh, it's just a file. Like it saves, writes my data. I didn't have to set it up. Like I have to run like a thing, but like it's not doing anything. Like, yeah, it's not a server running on my system. It just saves it out and accesses that file. That's cool.
And I don't even know what the I assume that that's not going to scale, you know?
No, that's not going to work for CodePen with millions of code like pens, no. But it'll work for. It'll work for my little test environment. So.
Right. And sometimes the database just feels good. It's the right way to do stuff. And for example, blogging. I think blogging with a database is a darn fine way to work. You know, I think a CMS is a place for a database, by God.
Mm-hmm. And I run a blog without it. I mean, like
it's not required. I mean, but yeah,
my database is just a loose contract of YAML had front matter like YAML in on top of a post, like a file, like a flat file, I don't know, collection. So you don't, data is interesting.
Yeah. You kind of have a data in a weird way.
I do. It's like each file is a row in my database. So it's weird
because it's that clean, you know, it's just metadata and data in a folder of files. So it's not a database, but it's like as close to a database as you can without being.
All Jekyll does is it reads all the files and it makes a big giant object, just like if you queried a database and got a big giant object. That's what it does. That's it. Hey, it's rocket science. It's all the same. It's arrays and objects and lists and all the way down.
All the way down.
Indeed. All the way down. Well, Chris, I think this is it. We have to wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Shop Talk Show. Be sure to star heart favorite it up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. Share us on Twitter. We're at Shop Talk Show on Twitter if you want to follow us for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your t-shirt, head over to shoptalkshow.com/shop, I believe it is. Get a brand new one. Look sharp this holiday season. And if you hate your job, Chris...
we got one for you. Listen up. This is at a company called Secret Escapes, secretescapes.com. Maybe you've heard of them. It's kind of a mid-sized company. You'll be joining about 200 people in their London office as a web designer. There's a great article in Marvel Apps blog about them and their design team. Of this company, there's 200 people in London. There's about 300 people in offices all around the world. So it's like a 500-person company, mid-sized company. The design team is only a handful of people, which is a subset of only 20 total people on their tech team. So you'll be, you know, you're working at a big company, but working on a smaller team doing really, and they say in this article, really data-driven design work, you know, design work that works because they know it works because they test it and build and prototype and test stuff. So it's just, it looks like a really cool company, a really beautiful office, a really good, I mean, I didn't even explain what they did, but Secret Escapes is this website where you go to for like, oh, I want to go on vacation, but I don't want to go to like the Motel 6 in Orlando or whatever. I want to go somewhere awesome. I want to go to a luxury hotel. I want to stay in like a health spa in South England, or I want to stay in like somewhere awesome in Iceland, or like a miniature castle somewhere. Go somewhere unique and fancy and 5-star and stuff. If you just go right to one of those websites, you're probably going to pay an arm for a leg for it. That's what fancy hotels are. But Secret Escapes
helps you find like the super discounts, up to 70% on luxury hotels, you know, around the world. And this isn't an advertisement for you to use Secret Escapes, although that's probably not a bad idea either. It's to work for them. Be the next web designer at Secret Escapes, which has been around 5 years and looks like it's kicking butt. So probably a pretty good team to join at this moment. So excellent communication skills, you're experienced front-end developer, you have an ability to think at a high level about project strategy and vision. You have to have a URL that shows off what you do. So, you know, that should be pretty clear. Have a website. 3+ years experience with e-commerce is a big plus. I bet a lot of you here at Shop Talk Show, listeners of Shop Talk Show, are the perfect person. This go work at Secret Escapes as their new web designer.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. Thanks, everyone, one more time. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, one more thing. ChopTalkShow.com.